Radio.
Traction or Friction, The Church and the World. A presentation by Dr. Philippa Marta at the Christopher Dawson Center for Cultural Studies 2015 Colloquium.
Can you hear me? Can everybody hear me? Can you see me?
Yes.
That's the other thing. Most people can't see me, but they can always hear me. That's very good. The title of my paper today is Traction or Friction, The Church and the World. And the whole church and world thing, this is the whole reason we're here. So it's not surprising that this is turning up as a theme over and over again. It's the whole driving force really behind anything to do with Christopher Dawson, because it was one of his great preoccupations as well. Because I have a choleric temperament, I'm very easily provoked. And so this paper, which I've written, emerged out of two very important provocations that I've copped in the last few years. The first provocation I copped, can you hear me? Is it me? You can't hear me, but no one else can. So you can see me. What if I do that? See, now I can't see what I'm reading. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Okay, my two provocations, because I get wound up about things. I went to a Campion College presentation, the symposium that was held in 2012, and I heard Francesca Murphy there. I don't know if any of you were there, but Francesca Murphy, who's a professor, she works at Notre Dame. She gave a presentation on a fascinating concept, and one which I didn't realise I'd actually been thinking about as well, but she put this idea out there about whether Christianity has had a Christianising effect on other world religions, particularly religions that existed before Christianity, such as Hinduism and Buddhism. Obviously, things that happened after Christianity, we can see the impact of Christianity on those religions. They've drawn very heavily, whether they like to admit it or not, such as Islam. And I immediately responded to this idea that she put out there with this enormous yes, because I hadn't realised that I'd actually been thinking along those lines myself. The redemption is like a sort of supernatural bath fizzer. It's dropped into creation and it's expanding and it's exploding and it's permeating everything in creation so that you can't actually separate it out from creation any longer. We can't go back to an unredeemed world now any more than, you know, the early Christians thought they could reverse their baptism with the bull's blood, that business in the cult of Mithras. We can't do that. It's actually done. C.S. Lewis puts it beautifully in those science fiction novels of his. The universe has turned a corner. Creation has turned a corner now, and we can't go back to an unredeemed world. So really, how could this central, very explosive event not affect other world religions? I mean, how could it not, when religion is all about that relationship with God? It's hard to see how Christianity couldn't have had that impact on it. So that was my first provocation. My second provocation was when I was asked to read and review and eventually to respond to an article that appeared in Connor Court Quarterly. I have to say that very carefully, Connor Court Quarterly, which is a periodical some of you may or may not read. This was a couple of years ago. It was an article called The Catholic Church and the Republic of Modernity. That was its original title. It was by a lady called Elena Douglas, and it was eventually published in the Quarterly as Letter to a New World Pope, 1. I read the first draft of this article, which was submitted to me because I'm on the editorial panel of that journal, and I was kind of peer reviewing it. And I had the most remarkable experience reading this article. It absolutely reeked of sweet reasonableness and pleasant moderation. It was an agenda she was proposing which really no right-thinking person could possibly want to agree with. And you actually felt bad disagreeing with her. She was writing, it was kind of more in sorrow than in anger, if you know what I mean, you know, helping us poor, unreconstructed, self-absorbed Promethean Neo-Pelagians into the church of the 21st century. And if you would like to read it, it is on the ABC website. My article is not, for some reason, but the one I wrote in response, but you can read that, and I've got the URL for that. Now, on my first reading of this article, I am absolutely not ashamed to tell you that I had the same experience that Gillian Eustace did in The Silver Chair, when the witch throws the powder on the fire and she gets out the mandolin and she's going thrum, 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 and she's reciting these very calming nostrums, and the children are going, yes, yes, you're absolutely right in every way. And you start to fall under that spell. And I thought, you know, if somebody as notoriously hard-headed and cynical as me is actually having this experience with this article, this is going to decimate kind people and nice people who have a pleasant temperament and a cheerful approach to life. So I decided to invoke the puddle glum response. I put my foot on the fire and used the pain and the foul smell to wake myself and everybody else up. And my eventual published response to this article was published as Letter to a New World Pope 2, and it came after Elena Douglas's in the same issue. It was extremely blunt. I don't think it was uncharitable. I was really writing to remind myself of why I am a Christian and what a wonderful thing that is to be and what a terrifying, tremendous thing the church really is and how selling it down the river to a transient thing called the Republic of Modernity is a terrible and ultimately a very pointless mistake to make. In my article, I made the following points. There's only four of them. Number one, the church is not some kind of cultural heritage precinct which exists to preserve lovely art and music, which is, I think, what Douglas was saying in her article. It's not the church's job to engage with modernity because modernity has something to offer the church. It's the church's job to engage with the world in order to save it. It's the perennial task of the church to engage with the world because that's why the church exists, to save the world. However, and my last point was, engaging with the world is a tricky process. And if the church goes about it the wrong way, we end up with nothing but trouble and no one gets saved. Elena Douglas had this thing called the Republic of Modernity, which she talked about quite a lot. And she seemed to think it was this very fine thing which had a lot to offer the church. It made me think of guillotines and blasphemous movies and death camps. And I said that in the article as well, but in a Christian way. I had to do a lot of additions. Anyway, so these two provocations, Francesca Murphy on the one side, who I got on really well with, and she had, I thought her ideas were fantastic, and Elena Douglas on the other, who I didn't agree with, but she really made me get thinking. These two provocations got me thinking about how and why we get our engagement with the world so wrong sometimes. And that led me to think that it's because we don't really understand how the church engages with the world. We don't understand the mechanics of it. And this includes me. I don't understand how this works. This is a mystery, and I'm not going to give you the whole answer today because this is just what I've been thinking about. And I was hoping to tell you what I think that relationship might look like, actually in a practical way. And to do this, I need to use some imagery. And the imagery that helps me explain things the best is that of wheels. Now, bear with me because this is a little bit out there, and it's not really an image we normally use of the church. I would go so far actually as to direct you back to scripture, to the Old Testament, to Ezekiel, first chapter of Ezekiel. If you like the book of Ezekiel, you're probably the same kind of person as me who likes reading things like the book of Ezekiel. It's completely out there, very vivid, prophetic, wild imagery. And in the first chapter of Ezekiel, we meet some wheels, some absolutely extraordinary wheels. Ezekiel sees heaven and he sees the winged seraphim around the throne of God, but he also sees cherubim. And they move these four enormous wheels. And the wheels even have a name. They're called the Ophanim in Hebrew. They turn in every direction. They're moved by the cherubim. They have eyes all over them. Sometimes you can see this in medieval manuscripts. You see these illustrations of these wheels within wheels. And there's four of them. And you don't have numbers by accident in books like Ezekiel or, in fact, anywhere in the Old Testament. It's the traditional Judeo-Christian number of creation, because it's three, which is the number of God, plus one. So four is always the number associated with things that are created, things in the created world, things that have a beginning. It's the world number. So where does the church fit into this? The early Christians tell us very clearly, and in fact this is in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, the world was created for the sake of the church. The church is the goal of all things in the world. And Clement of Alexandria says, and this is again from the Catechism, just as God's will is creation and is called the world, so his intention is the salvation of men, and it is called the church. So we have the world and we have the church existing with each other and for each other. And I think wheels are a useful image of looking at this, if you like, wheels within wheels. And don't knock the wheel, because if we hadn't come up with it, we wouldn't be nearly as comfortable as we are today. The wheel is a very potent symbol. It's just one we normally associate with religions other than Christianity because of cycles. But actually, wheels have a place in Christian symbolism as well. Wheels are useful to me because I find I can best talk about the relationship between the church and the world in terms of mechanics. And again, this is a little bit unusual because we're used to organic language with the church. We talk about, you know, the tree that's got the branches that's big enough to hold everyone, or it's a body. It's something that grows and changes over time from its original seed. We always use that very organic language normally when we're talking about the church. But I actually don't see why we can't use mechanical language as well. And the language that I like to think of in this sense is traction and friction. So for those of you who don't care less about mechanics, just bear with me for a moment. Traction is, and I quote, the process of a force moving or transmitting power across another surface. And one of the things you need to get traction happening is a little bit of friction. That's that grip, the resistance that happens when you try to move something across something else. And I actually think this is a really good way of looking at the relationship between the church and the world. Mechanical language is every bit as relevant to natural law as organic laws. So we tend to forget that because we're used to that organic imagery again. But the mechanical laws are also laws of nature, and as in nature, so in grace. So I think we can actually get away with this. I think where we go wrong is that we have wrong ideas about the relationship between those two surfaces. The church is hugely dynamic. And by contrast, the world is actually very static. I think that the church is the moving force, moving across the surface of the world. And as it moves, it changes that surface and it actually improves it because it's drawing it forward all the time. The trouble is that a lot of people out there have the opposite idea. They believe it's the world that's doing the moving. The world is the dynamic force. The church is a great big monolith that's stuck and it needs to be dragged forward, kicking and screaming. And the world is actually doing the church a favour. Doing this, it's improving it by forcing the church to conform to the world's standards. And I used some examples in that article of how we get this wrong. This is like the church on a big institutional scale. One of the examples I used was the Inquisition, the Spanish Inquisition. Now, in its day, the secular Inquisition in Spain was the cutting edge of modernity. It started in 1478. That's the very, very beginning of the modern era. The nation state is just starting to form. This is clearly the political way of the future. We're going to do things this way for the next 500 years at least. So what better form of aggiornamento than for the church to jump in at the ground level and engage with this emerging state and this emerging way of dealing with political problems? And yet, of course, today we're apologising for it because actually we got that one wrong. Now, if you're not comfortable with the Inquisition as an example, I know a lot of people are very touchy on the subject of the Inquisition, and there are, you know, people say we shouldn't have apologised, and that's fine. If you don't like that example, think of some of the others. The Byzantine Empire, another example where the church got over-engaged with the world. Gallicanism in France, the Reformation in England, all absolutely cutting-edge modern movements of their time, and the church engaged, and it over-engaged. And we know from our history that the church came off second best in all of these situations and people suffered. And that wonderful forward movement that the church is supposed to be bringing to the world sank instead into the mire. The world didn't benefit and neither did the church. Now, how can I stand up here and say that with a straight face and my hand on my heart saying, I, Philippa Martyr, know that this was the case? I don't. I'm simply speculating because I know God can bring good out of bad. We know that, you know, the bad stuff that's happened in history, we can see how God has worked with that and brought good out of it. I will tell you, though, that I read a wonderful counterfactual history once and I've never been able to find it since. So if anyone can find it for me, I'll be very grateful. It postulated a Renaissance England after the victory of the Spanish Armada. And it was an England that blossomed with art and music and learning, and it led the civilised world, and it produced a Catholic North America. And when I tell Protestant friends about this, they are appalled because they just can't. They can't imagine the Protestant, the Armada victory ever being a good thing. This includes Keith Windschuttle, who's a very dear friend of mine, who he's a great thinker outside the box in so many ways, but because he comes from that very evangelical Protestant background, it was like, no way, how could you say that? And we had quite a row about it, because it's just a counterfactual and it's just a way of speculating, but we don't know, but we can certainly speculate about that. So the church, as we know, it's been described before as like a chariot of fire. It's something moving forward all the time. You would know Chesterton, his famous quote in Orthodoxy, "The heavenly chariot flies thundering through the ages, the dull heresies sprawling and prostrate, the wild truth reeling but erect." The Ofarim, those wheels in the first book of Ezekiel, they are traditionally believed to be the wheels under the throne of God that move God. Everywhere he wants to go, you find those wheels moving underneath him. As the church moves forward through time and space, it draws the world along with it. Because you need that little bit of friction, there is an ouch factor involved in this, and the ouch factor happens to us usually, but it is a necessary and good part of that process of moving the world forward and improving it as that traction and friction happens. But when you over-engage with the world, you get too much friction, you stop, you damage both the church and the world, and as we know in the spiritual life, if you're not going forwards, you're going backwards. There's no stasis in the spiritual life, and that's what happens, I think, with the church and the world as well. We seize up and we start drifting backwards. We all know this stuck and paralyzed feeling. Just on an external level, if you've had to attend the more egregious examples of modern liturgies, and I use modern in inverted commas, I go to the Novus Ordo myself, but I mean the kinds of liturgies where you have draped fabrics and the earthenware. What is with the earthenware here? Always with the earthenware. This kind of thing, it feels so fossilized. It feels so stuck. And yet the people doing that think it's ever so modern, but that's because they're stuck in a particular era. I think you see the same kind of stasis and drift in religious orders that over-engaged with the world in the 60s and 70s and have lost all their vocations and don't now seek new vocations because they've lost that divine traction that should have kept their, or no, maybe not, would have kept their religious order moving forward and reforming as it needed to reform. I once actually saw a real-life example of exactly the process I'm talking about. It was World Youth Day in Sydney a few years ago, and there was that huge procession of young Catholics walking through Sydney, absolutely thousands of them. It was a beautiful thing. And a group of protesters got the right to jeer at them and throw condoms. And I watched the footage of this, and what I saw was a procession that kept moving forward all the time past a fixed group of protesters who couldn't go anywhere and couldn't do anything except throw condoms. And of course, they could throw as many condoms as they like, but no one was picking them up. People were just moving past them, leaving them behind. And I thought when I saw that, there is the church. There is everything you need to know about the Catholic Church. It's moving. It's these people who are stuck. And they're absolutely stuck in the one place. And then much to my delight, I discovered Christopher Dawson agreed with me because he wrote a whole book called Progress and Religion, which cheered me up no end. So, of course, he's quite correct because he agrees with me. He's not the only person who agrees with me, I've discovered to my delight. Rodney Stark, if you've read any of his books, Rodney Stark has written about 20 books. Actually, he's only written about 3 books, but he's published them under what are effectively different titles or mixed them. I don't know. I'm all in favour of this because he's got a really good core message. If he has to publish it under 20 different titles, more power to his pen. He writes wonderful books. The one I like particularly is The Victory of Reason. And he believes that everything that's authentically modern and positive in human history has been brought about by Christianity. Decent social and legal treatment of women, that's one example. Basic capitalism that's alleviated poverty all over the world. And the scientific method that's allowed us actually to make any kind of technological process. These are 3 examples of huge improvements in our lives which the church has brought to the world through this process of traction, through the process of drawing the world forward. Now, I know C.S. Lewis warns us in the Screwtape Letters that we don't use Christianity as a form of social improvement. That's a bad idea. It becomes Christianity and eventually the Christianity drops off and you just have the social movement. What you have to do instead, of course, is get your Christianity right. And then when you're getting your Christianity right, one of the ways you'll know that is that you will want to engage with the world to save it, to draw it forward with you. Because the interface, that surface where all of that action is taking place, is actually us. And it's taking place inside us in our personal spiritual battle, and it's taking place outside us in our engagement one-to-one with other people and with groups of people, and it's taking place on a bigger level with our institutions. So, you know, the people of the Renaissance were right when they wrote about the macrocosm and the microcosm. It's all happening, but it's actually happening with us. What you can't do is opt out of this process. And I was very pleased to hear Anna saying this morning, that the opting out of the whole thing, that's not an option for a Christian person. Even people who become hermits or people who go into enclosed religious life, they are so not opting out. And I can tell you, I was in enclosed religious life for 5 years. That's not an escape from anything. Absolutely not. You know, that's if you're on the great bark of Peter, lay people are up on the decks, and guess who's shoveling the coal? That would be the people in enclosed religious life, actually, down in the coal hole, shoveling away for dear life. So it's not an escape from the world. Where you do see people trying to escape from the world is when people do become horrified by what we see and hear around us, and they tend to withdraw and they stop engaging, and you can end up with those funny little cults that we sometimes see happening, or we see proto-cults almost bubbling up sometimes in our local Catholic communities, people who try really to live separatist sorts of lives. And they always go wrong. We know that because that's not what the church is designed for. The church is not a club for nice people and a place to hide from the world. It's actually a very living and active thing that we're out there actually doing stuff with. How you do that is up to you, but you cannot withdraw from that process and opt out. So if you as an individual are living your Christian life to the full, then you're drawn forward into that process. But if you as an individual Christian start getting bogged down in the world, then you do stop and you do start going backwards and you do become fossilised. Even if you get fossilised in a good time, you're still fossilised, and it's not our job to be fossils. God didn't make us to be fossils. He made us to be living things that keep living so that we actually live forever. It's so important to stay engaged always with that impetus and that dynamism and that freedom that Christianity gives you. This idea of traction and friction, to me, it helps explain the discomfort of the process that we all experience from time to time, but it should also reassure us that the discomfort can actually be a good sign. You know, as they say, you don't get flak unless you're over the target. And I think it's the same with this process. It's so true. I found that to be so true. When you're copping the most of the flak, you are right over the target. This discomfort can be a good sign that we're actually doing our job properly. And it also reminds us that ultimately the interaction between the church and the world is under God's direction. Those wheels are under God's throne. You know, so we have to do what we can do. We can't do everything, but as long as we're being faithful to our individual Christian commitment, I think you will feel that sense of wanting to engage with the world, not run away from it, but actually to draw it forward. So those are my thoughts, and I would be very glad to hear what you think, particularly if someone's written an entire book about this and I've not read it. It would be really good if I could find out about that now and I can think about something else for a while. So thank you very much for listening.
That was Dr. Philippa Marta with Traction or Friction, The Church and the World. This presentation was part of the Christopher Dawson Center for Cultural Studies 2015 colloquium on the theme, Ideas Dangerous to Atheism. For more talks, interviews and shows, visit cradio.org.au.